Well, this week the news has been dominated again by the spiralling number of women in our communities murdered by men. 4 women in the past fortnight, 28 women so far this year. That's one every 4 days. The Prime Minister's called it a national crisis, and then he convened an emergency meeting of National Cabinet. There's been a lot said by politicians and other experts with official titles since that meeting of state and federal leaders. But one group of people with a crucial perspective on the impact of this violence and the gaps in the system to deal with it are those who've been directly affected. Next week, the Commissioner for Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence will convene national crisis discussions into missing and murdered women. One woman who has a seat at that table is Imani Haider from the National Lived Experience Council. Her mother was stabbed to death by her father 9 years ago. Imani was 5 months pregnant at the time, and her 18-year-old sister was a witness to the frenzied attack. Since then, Imani has written a memoir, it's called The Mother Wound, about life leading up to this shattering event and the aftermath. I spoke with her earlier.
Hi, Fran. Thanks for having me.
Imani, such a horrific act of violence perpetrated by your own father against your beloved mother. Does this give you a unique insight into not just the impact of family violence like this on all members of the family, but also onto how we might curb this crisis of violence against women? What do you bring to this crisis roundtable next week?
It absolutely does give me a lot of insight, and it's insight that nobody really wants to have, but I think victim survivors such as myself have really unique perspectives that are shaped by the way that they've experienced violence from their own context and are able to speak to some niche issues that aren't always captured more broadly. So I was 5 months pregnant when my mum was murdered. I'm a visibly Muslim person. I come from a community that also experiences racism that for a lot of women compounds their experiences of gender-based violence and creates certain barriers. I also come from a community where there are lots of people who are migrants and may face language barriers and other issues like that. So when I talk about my experiences, a lot of this context shapes the way that I went through the grief after losing mum. Mm. It shapes the way that I advocate, and it shapes some of the priority areas that I've identified through that advocacy over the past few years. I was also a practicing lawyer up until the date of the murder, and I found through the legal system and through my dad's trial, where I testified and also gave a victim impact statement, that the experience of being a victim and a witness within the legal process can actually be quite disempowering. A lot of victim survivors talk about how the legal system can be overwhelming and disempowering and marginalizing, but it wasn't until I really experienced that shift from being someone who practiced in courtrooms and spoke in courtrooms to being someone who was having those questions directed at them, that I became aware of how many challenges we have in terms of improving the legal system for people like me.
So tell me a bit more about that before we get to the other elements of it. What did it feel like being inside that legal system as a victim survivor? What was that like?
I'm lucky. I had legal training. I had experience in courtrooms. I understand the rules of evidence. I became the person that my family went to understand what was happening, to get some sort of analysis about what was going on. And despite that knowledge, despite my experience, I still felt that that day giving evidence in court was one of the most frightening, overwhelming, difficult days I've ever had to go through, and probably second to the day of the murder, probably the worst day of my life.
Can you give us a sense of that? Why was it that's a strong thing to say, that probably the second most difficult day after the day of the murder itself?
Well, first of all, when we go through a DV-related homicide, the legal system doesn't sort of automatically distinguish that sort of homicide from other homicides. So you're going through a trial without any of the usual sensitivity that victims of domestic violence might get if they're going through AVO proceedings, for example. Mm-hmm. We had support from the homicide victims support group, and that was great. It's really important to have a support person present and to be able to access counselling while going through something like this. But at the same time, it was incredibly overwhelming how public the event was. These things need to be public. We have a public interest in keeping trials open for society to be able to see what goes on in courtrooms. But it did add a real feeling of being hyper-visible, having your life laid out really suddenly and abruptly and scrutinized in the courtroom can be really daunting. I guess something really important that I try to describe to people, it was the first time that I'd ever confronted my dad since the murder had taken place. I hadn't seen him for a couple of weeks before the murder. To walk into a courtroom 2 years later, having waited all that time with all that uncertainty and all that suspense, to then give evidence against someone who had really betrayed us in the worst possible way, was really intimidating.
So, Amani, from that experience, which, as you say, gives you a unique perspective that many other women have shared, what is it that you would bring to this table about changes required in the legal system, the system you've been trained in?
One of the key focus areas I think we need to look at is making sure that across the legal profession, lawyers, judges, and anyone else who sort of operates in that space, there is adequate training around how to be trauma-informed and how to properly understand the dynamics of power and control that take place in domestic violence cases.
But Amani, we've been talking about this for years. Doesn't that already happen to some extent?
No, there's no compulsory training, for example, for law students that they have to undertake in order to understand what trauma looks like and how it affects people's presentation in court and how to be a little bit more sensitive when dealing with victims and witnesses. There's no compulsory learning around domestic violence and what that, how that's shaped by gendered language, how that's shaped by various social factors that lawyers have to undergo before they actually start operating as professionals.
Amani, this week our political leaders came up with a package of measures to intensify the fight back against this epidemic of violence against women. What did you think of those national leaders' response?
It's not enough. We have solutions. Communities and organizations that are really embedded in and familiar with their communities have solutions and have ways of working with women that can really minimize risk, but they struggle because there isn't longevity when it comes to funding. There's uncertainty and a manufactured sense of scarcity in the funding landscape. There are gaps in relation to migrant and refugee women who can't necessarily access supports that are culturally sensitive or available in the languages that they speak.
What do you think would help? Because the Prime Minister has said, he's been up front, he said there's more to do, and we know that's true on many fronts. What do you think the first thing government should do then?
I'd love to see organisations like Women's Health Centres that are already really good at working with their communities to intervene in crisis situations receive funding to set up crisis hubs, for example, where people can go as a first point of contact to disclose their experiences as an alternative to attending a police station. And whilst Women's Health Centres do a great job in their communities, they're under-resourced in that way.
But are you talking about instead of going to the police? I mean, if a woman is wanting to flee a violent situation, she needs to alert the police to the threat, doesn't she? Otherwise, how does she stay safe and how does the perpetrator face any restraint or consequences?
Absolutely. There need to be mechanisms for accountability, and police do play a role as first responders in these situations. Not all women, however, feel safe immediately turning up to a police station. They might need someone to escort them there. They might want to know their options first. So handing back some agency when someone has lost control over their lives already can be a really good way of re-empowering them, of making them feel like they have options.
So we've talked about a couple of ideas immediately, changes to the legal service system, change this notion of community hubs. Journalist and domestic violence researcher Jess Hill wrote recently that healing is prevention. How do you heal from this kind of trauma, Amani, if you ever really can?
I've been lucky to access things that work for me, but it took quite a while to navigate what was available, find out what was working, and really reclaim a sense of control over my life. There are gaps in relation to getting legal advice about the things that happen in the aftermath of a murder, for example, property-related issues, estate-related issues, but there are also gaps for young people and children who've witnessed abuse. We know from research that the long-term ramifications of witnessing violence at home can lead to a need for lifelong counselling. From my own experiences and from having spoken to people who share an experience of being bereaved by a DV-related homicide, I know that the responses that are available for children and young people is actually currently inadequate. There was a report released by Melbourne University just late last year about children and young people bereaved by domestic homicide, and it outlines the ways in which we face challenges providing that particular group with really good long-term support.
So you're talking about counselling? Is that what you mean, long-term counselling? I mean, when a child witnesses or survives family violence, do we have support counselling service for children? Is that the automatic response?
Often I think children might be referred to services, but they're also kind of treated like a bit of a footnote to the primary victim's experience. So they might be able to access some general counselling. They might be put in touch with various services, but it really is up to their carers, whoever that ends up being, to follow through with that and make sure that it's working and that it's effective and that it's meeting that child's unique needs. A lot of young people also feel silenced about these experiences. They've got to deal with stigma. They've got to deal with the stress of school and the usual things that a young person goes through. And then on top of that, this real huge upheaval that comes with losing one parent and having the other parent incarcerated as a result of that violence as well. So what I really think is missing is a focus on those perspectives, those voices, making sure, again, that the services that these children will ultimately be put in touch with are able to provide that continuous long-term support, and making sure that the community understands how life-altering this kind of trauma can be, because even that can be ignored sometimes.
So are we talking about more funding for that kind of ongoing counselling for kids, or are we talking about more training so people know how to do that and we have the counsellors out there to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we would benefit from both. In New South Wales, there's an organisation called the Homicide Victim Support Group, and they're the group that I went to for counselling and court-related support after the murder of my mum. They don't exist in every state, and I've been shocked to hear from other people bereaved by a DV homicide in Victoria, for example, that there was no equivalent service that they were referred to after their families went through a similar experience to mine. I've been shocked to learn that some children put in the care of family members who might be sympathetic to the offender, never really told the full story about what has happened to their mum, never really given the opportunity to express their own fears and frustrations around any of those things. So there is definitely a gap there. I've connected with other victim survivors who have had this experience, and we're trying to see what we can do in this space. But it definitely is a really important area so far as prevention is concerned, because intervening when people are young is really a form of prevention, and providing those people with long-term recovery options and support is also a form of prevention.
And let's just talk about that Jess Hill quote, healing is prevention. What's the cost of not providing that support to survivor victims to heal, Amani?
Well, a lot of the long-term consequences of this kind of trauma can include, you know, disengagement from study, disengagement from employment. PTSD can be incredibly debilitating. A lot of people assume that if you're experiencing a mental illness, it shouldn't be a barrier to physically attending work or physically doing certain activities, but it can be really, really debilitating. It can be really hard to raise children while you're going through that kind of mental distress. I know that once my baby was born, a few months after Mum was murdered, I really struggled to cope with the stress of a new baby on top of the stress of a homicide and on top of the betrayal and the sense of confusion that I was dealing with. So PTSD, all of the different, the related symptoms, all of the long-term anxiety, depression, et cetera, that can come with these sorts of experiences. These are treatable conditions. There are ways to work with survivors.
And but something we need to perhaps more insidious than that too, patterning, so that, you know, you might grow up to be a perpetrator or you might grow up to be a serial victim, I suppose, if you've experienced this violence growing up.
That's right. Intervening meaningfully means giving young people especially an opportunity to question some of the behaviours that they might have been exposed to in their environment. And whilst not everyone who's exposed to abuse will end up being an abuser, in fact, sometimes people who haven't been exposed to any abuse choose to use violence against a partner. We do have the opportunity to meaningfully intervene by providing adequate long-term mental health supports to people who have been exposed to DV, and to make sure that that's comprehensive and that it's covered by Medicare and that it's not delivered just by general counselling services. I think specialised, tailored supports are really, really important.
You wrote the story of your mother's death and the experience of it in your book titled Mother Wound, and you write, how do we fix all that damage that is passed on through mothers because of their experiences of living in a patriarchal society? And you went on to talk about stitching oneself back together after the wounds and experiences. How do you stitch yourself back together so the trauma doesn't go on leaking and affecting others? What do you need to be able to do that successfully?
I think that sense of security comes from being able to reestablish meaningful relationships with others. And for me, that's been through my community, through my faith. I experience intergenerational trauma in a number of ways. And one of those is that my mum's own mother was a victim of a homicide. She was killed in an Israeli airstrike in 2006. I know that that would have had a profound impact on my mum's life. These broader social and political contexts really change the way that people navigate the world and our sense of safety within it. I would love to see a society where everyone is treated equally and is able to thrive. I'd like to see a society where we can draw parallels between interpersonal abuse and state-sanctioned abuse, because I know from my own experience that those things are connected, and I know from the literature that those things are connected. So in order to have safer societies, I think we need to challenge cultures of violence wherever we may find them. And I think there's a lot of important conversation happening in this place right now, and really calling to account governments and corporations. How do we change that culture? How do we disrupt that culture? How do we avoid creating societies where violence is normalized against certain populations?
Amani Haider, thank you very much for joining me on Saturday Extra.
Thank you so much, Fran. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
That's Amani Haider from the National Lived Experience Council. And the full longer interview with Amani will be on the ABC Listen app and on our Saturday Extra website.